You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
Call your big black bottom and put you in a trance. Early one morning, about break of day, Grandpa told Grandma, I heard him say, get on up and show your old man your black bottom. I want to learn that dance.
Yes, sir.
I want to learn that dance.
That was the title song from the acclaimed new Netflix movie Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Adapted from two-time Pulitzer Prize winner August Wilson's play and brilliantly directed by renowned stage and film director George C. Wolfe, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom celebrates the transformative power of the blues and stars Oscar winner Viola Davis as the woman forever known as the mother of the blues who refused to let society's prejudices dictate her own worth. Today, George C. Wolfe comes on the podcast to talk about the importance of the blues as a form of oral history for African Americans, the undeniable legacy of the original diva, Gertrude Ma Rainey, and what went into transforming Viola Davis into this music icon with only 7 original photographs of Ma to go by. He discusses what the Chicago jazz scene meant to black musicians who migrated from the Jim Crow South in the 1920s, the creative ways he found to visually depict the foreignness of the urban North for those who made that journey, and why he chose to shoot the movie in August Wilson's hometown of Pittsburgh as a stand-in for the Windy City. George opens up about the process of bringing August Wilson's play to the screen, why he always has an intense rehearsal period before he shoots a frame of film, how his own experience as an occasional actor informs his directing, and how he got the performance of a lifetime out of the late Chadwick Boseman. Plus, we talk about the white bandleader who appropriated black music and then had the nerve to bill himself as the king of jazz, the relevance of Ma Rainey's story in the wake of last year's Black Lives Matter protests, and the swirl of Oscar buzz surrounding this 5-time Tony-winning director and this monumental motion picture. Coming up with George C. Wolfe in just a moment. George C. Wolfe is a renowned director and playwright of theater and film. This 5-time Tony Award winner has firmly established himself as one of America's most important and influential cultural voices, with the ability to deftly command both the worlds of stage and film. Wolfe most recently directed the movie Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, starring Viola Davis and Chadwick Boseman. The film, which is based on a play by August Wilson, opened to wide acclaim and quite a bit of Oscar buzz, so today I'm delighted to have him on the show to talk about this remarkable film and the equally remarkable woman who inspired it. George C. Wolfe, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I have to say, I was already predisposed to love this movie, just because, for whatever reason, I'm one of those strange people who is steeped in the music of the 1920s and routinely ends up on Spotify rabbit holes that lead from Bessie Smith to Ma Rainey to Sippy Wallace and, you know, increasingly obscure blues singers.
No, it's extraordinary. It was an extraordinary time, extraordinary music.
Absolutely. And this is not the first time that you've dealt with that period, the 1920s, or even the music of the 1920s. One of the first Broadway shows I ever saw was your first Broadway show, Jelly's Last Jam.
Oh, wow. Okay.
What draws you to that specific era?
Well, because I think it was when America found its voice, when it was liberated from the European control and found its own odd, idiosyncratic voice, which in turn dominated the world. So and so that's thrilling, and it's also a time where a language was evolving and an attitude was evolving, and the creative output was astonishing in terms of in every aspect. And then everything crashed, and then fascism started to rise, and you know, so I think it's just it's an endlessly fascinating period to me.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I need to stop doing projects that are set in the 20s, but anytime something comes up, I go, okay, here I go again. But I only slightly really complain because I love digging in.
Yeah, I do get a sense that there's quite a bit of the historian in you.
There is. As time goes on, even more so, which I think is probably a good thing. But I don't know. I helped to create this museum in Atlanta called the Center for Civil and Human Rights, in which I staged the civil rights movement. And at one point, the guy who was in charge, Doug Shipman, very smart guy, you know, he said, if you didn't do what you did, what would you be? And I said, I'd be a historian. So,
really?
And I was sort of shocked that I said that, but not. But so I owned it and I claim it. What the hell?
Now, in some sense, Ma Rainey has largely been lost to history. Prior to this movie coming out, I would honestly bet that probably 99 folks out of 100 could not tell you who Ma Rainey was.
Absolutely.
So I really applaud you for bringing this forgotten icon to the forefront again. I'm curious what drew you to Ma Rainey.
Well, you know, I said, sorry, interrupting you. I said, really applaud August Wilson for giving her a play and putting her name in the title of the play. I one of the things that I think is I'm really fascinated by people who did something really significant, but history has not been kind. At one point when I was putting together this moment at the end where we see actually images of Ma Rainey, I discovered that there are a total of 7 photographs of Ma Rainey.
Wow.
In existence. 7.
That's
which is
amazing.
Astonishing for someone who is called the mother of the blues. I mean, there are thankfully so hundreds and hundreds of pictures of Bessie Smith, hundreds of pictures of Duke Ellington, of Fanny Bryce, of any number of performers, you know, who were working at the exact same time as she was, 7 total. And so that was really fascinating. Then, I love the 20s. I was intrigued by Chicago. I'd never really done anything that was set in Chicago. This is August has written 10 plays, and this is the only one of his that he wrote that's part of his cycle that's not set in Pittsburgh. The other ones, they're all set in Pittsburgh, and this is set in Chicago. So I was really intrigued by that. I was intrigued by, you know, the language and the writing, which is extraordinary. And I don't know, it was just Steve and the making of. And at the core of it is the making, the recording of songs. And so I was intrigued by that phenomenon of what happens when you take, you know, there's this wonderful line that Ma Rainey has, Ma sings what's in her heart. Ma, you know, and so you have a person who is an artist and a gifted artist and a very shrewd business person, but like most artists is she's ruled by the desire to tell stories or to communicate or connect with people. And you put somebody like that in a situation where it's about commerce. And that dichotomy between somebody who is, for lack of better words, pure and why she does what she does. She's not a pure person because nobody's pure. But somebody who is pure in why she does what she does, and you put her in a situation where the stakes and the ambitions and the event is anything but pure.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and that dichotomy, I think, is really, really fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, when I listen to the music of Ma Rainey, whether it's in the film, which has an amazing score, by the way, or just the original recordings, the thing that strikes me is that she has absolutely lived every word of those songs. They are really a part of her. They are her story. And I can't imagine that it was very easy for her to give over those pieces of herself to the white record producers to be exploited for money. Was coming from the South to Chicago a little bit of a deal with the devil for musicians?
Well, no, I think there were, it was opportune. I mean, it's complicated. You know, Jelly Roll Morton left, you know, speaking of Jelly, Jelly Morton left New Orleans and toured around, and then he ended up in Chicago, and he had a very successful career there. He ran into complications when he came to New York, because by the time he arrived in New York, the sophisticated harmonics of Duke Ellington were in vogue, and his sort of New Orleans-based sound, brilliant musician though he was not in vogue. So Chicago held a lot of promise for a lot of musicians, particularly a lot of Black musicians. And with the closing of Storyville, the legal whorehouse area in New Orleans, which employed a lot of musicians, when they shut that down, you know, around the time of World War I, that's when a lot of the musicians traveled to Chicago to find employment. So I think for some, you know, it's always the case, which is for some, you know, one man's oasis is another man's hell. And I think for Ma, who toured around, but in the South, she had her own entertainment, for lack of better words, empire, where she was in charge. Yeah. She was the boss. She was in command. You know, people paid her, and she in turn paid the people who worked for her and was very clear about her identity. You know, she owned two theaters in Georgia. So I think for her, and for a number of people, it was complicated because in her realm in the South, she was the power broker. Mm-hmm. When she comes North, she's going to have to enter into power dynamics with white producers and white agents and white managers. And I think it was very, very, and you know, particularly in the film, it was very, very challenging for her. But at the same time, she didn't back down. And that dynamic of an artist fighting, you know, in the specifics of this, an artist, specifically Black, specifically a woman, but an artist fighting for her worth in a landscape that would choose not to acknowledge her worth is kind of a thrilling thing to watch. It's always thrilling when somebody stands up and says, no, you don't get to treat me this way. Yeah. There's something thrilling and heroic when you see that, when that happens.
Yeah, I think that we have kind of this idea of the Great Northern Migration, in which Black musicians like Ma, Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll, Bessie Smith left the Deep South and came to Chicago. We almost have this image of it as if, you know, the moment they hopped off of the train and walked into a club, Al Capone would put 10 grand in their pocket and they'd be on their way without a care in the world. Suddenly they're famous and they don't have to deal with Black problems anymore. They don't have to deal with racism, but they did.
Yeah, no, and you know, because it's Twas ever thus. America is perpetually caught in this conversation with itself about, you know, the idea versus the reality. Mm-hmm. The idea of America is extraordinary. The idea of America is phenomenal, you know. And then there is the reality of getting there and the journey of getting there and the consequences of people who find themselves on the outside of that idea. And success and fame can create an illusion, but it doesn't shatter the truth of what was going on. And you know, I mean, you have somebody like Duke Ellington, who is an incredible artist, a genius musician, sophisticated arranger, playing at the Cotton Club, which is intrinsically a complicated dynamic because it's at the time it's right in the middle of Harlem. Ironically enough, you know, the mobsters took over a club from Jack Johnson, the fighter, and they established the Cotton Club there. And it's right in the middle of Harlem, and it's for white performers. It's for white audience members and Black performers.
Right.
And Black performers had to make a very specific entrance into the club and appear on stage, but with rare exceptions where they are ever allowed to sit there. So you have a person creating some of the most sophisticated harmonics and sounds of the moment in a situation where he is being celebrated that is intrinsically compromised. Mm-hmm. So it's and some of his early compositions, as I'm sure you know, were written by Duke Ellington and Irving Mills, his manager. His manager didn't write those, but those are the deals that people had to make on the journey of hopefully achieving some kind of career and artistic autonomy.
Now, you open this movie with a scene of Ma performing at one of her tent shows out in an open field somewhere in the South, and the electric energy of the crowd and the sense of community, which I think makes just such a great contrast when we see the glare and the concrete and the oppressiveness of Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely.
Visually, you give a real idea of just how foreign Chicago must have felt for Southern blacks. What went into creating that contrast?
Well, what became very interesting to me at one point, Ma has a line with her manager Irving and when she's arguing about something, and she says, you know, if she doesn't get it, you know, I can take my ass back down south because I don't like it up here no how. and that became a really fascinating thing to me. And then I went like, oh, so from the turn of the century of the last century to 1920, over 100,000 black people moved into Chicago from the South because of the job opportunities. And they're being paid and they're working in factories, and sometimes the factory work is unbelievably brutal, but they have their own, but they have these wages that they are receiving, and they have their own community, and violent things are happening, but there's a sense of possibility. But for Ma, who was powerful and in the South, it was very important that I wanted to convey that she was in charge of her career in the South. Mm-hmm. Yes, lynching, yes, Jim Crow laws, yes, these statues have been erected, you know, about Confederate heroes, which we are now finally addressing. All of that was going on, but in the equation of segregation, she was able to build her own and build an empire, if you will. And I call her a showbiz entrepreneur. And so she was able to create her own. And so that sense of command for a personality like her and for a force like her going to Chicago was a necessary journey because she was making these records and they were selling well. But she's also at a point in time in her career where she's being usurped by Bessie Smith. She's being usurped by a new sound. It's no longer, yes, it's about the singers, but it's all of a sudden we're getting ready into the era of the band leader, Duke Ellington and his orchestra. You know, and there is the singer with the band. The singer is not the star. The band leader is the star. And so the times are changing, as is the case with all artists. You know, you look up one day and the world has changed on you. And I think she's dealing with that, with Bessie Smith, who she taught and was probably her lover, but there's no official
right,
you know, text
right.
that support that. But somebody younger than you is having a career that's full of possibilities that weren't available for you. So it's a complicated dynamic. So Chicago, I think, is a very mixed bag for her because she's got to negotiate a relationship with somebody else's power structure. And at least as crafted by August Wilson, I would say brilliantly crafted, Ma's a person who doesn't do that well.
And by the way, I just have to tell you, this is something that I don't think was in the original play. I think this is something that you added, which I love you for, is you get a great dig in at Paul Whiteman, the fat white band leader who billed himself as the king of jazz, but he's really the king of cultural appropriation.
Yes, absolutely. Or my favorite is the concert that he had at Carnegie Hall, which quote unquote made a lady out of jazz. As if jazz was asking to be made a lady. Get the idea. Paul Whiteman is a bit, he's a complicated figure for me.
Yeah, but you know, speaking of making a lady out of jazz, it's all the funnier because in that scene, you see him in this band full of straight-laced white guys playing a song about a jelly roll, which was a colloquial term in early jazz for the vagina. Yes, and you can tell they have no clue what they're actually singing about.
Exactly. My jelly roll. Yes. No, exactly. No, I, you know, that was at one point that came to me very early on. I'd say we have to, hopefully by that point in the movie, you know, even though Levy is in many respects a knucklehead, he's gifted and he's smart, and we've learned about his ambition, and we've even more so learned about his pain, so that therefore when that violation occurs, hopefully we feel it. We feel what's been taken from him.
Definitely, definitely. Now, you know, again, I keep getting down these weird rabbit holes that maybe only I appreciate, but this may very well be just me getting in the weeds. But I was wondering, as I watched this, how much of Chadwick Boseman's character, Levy, was influenced or modeled on Louis Armstrong? Because I know Louis played with Ma, and some of the jazz riffs that he does in there very much resembled the opening of Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7 recording.
That's interesting, yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, Armstrong... You know, Louis Armstrong came out on the other. This is a loaded statement, but I'll make it. Louis and his music came out on the other side of the racism that he confronted. Mm-hmm. His greatness, you know, was so extraordinary that lives on. Mm-hmm. And the obstacles that he encountered and the brutality that he encountered is in the music, but his career soared past it. Levy isn't so lucky, but it's a really interesting question. It's a really interesting question because Ma played with a lot of musicians who later had great careers, but August chose to focus in on these guys who were, as they say, an accompaniment band. They were designed to play exactly what she wanted them to play, versus there's this interesting tension between Ma and Levy, because he's so young and so reckless and she's very rigid in what she wants, but also he's this blues jazz artist that's emerging, and that is the shape of what's to come. Mm. And she has no tolerance for that. Yeah. You know, it also doesn't help that he goes after her girlfriend. It's never a good idea to try to sleep with your boss's lover. So that's a bad idea, just all around.
We're gonna take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, when you're bringing a beloved play by none other than August Wilson to the screen, and you have to make the choices of how to open it up and make it cinematic, but still respect the work, that has to be a difficult needle to thread. Do you have some kind of metric or heuristic that you relied on for making those kind of decisions?
Well, every single, there's no method or metric. But every single visual moment that happens, it came from me asking a question. Oh, Ma says, I don't like it up here anyhow. Why is she saying that? Oh, she owned this theater. She was this. Oh, well, we need to see that. Boom. Mm. Oh, Levy is obsessed with this door. Oh, what's on the other side of that door? What's on the other side of that door? And I ask that question, and then a visual comes to me. Or we see Levy, Levy went out to buy these shoes. Oh, Bronzeville was this black neighborhood in Chicago, and those 100,000 black people who moved there all moved into this one area. And so that became really interesting. And so that for Chicago, some people ended up flourishing. And then for other people, it didn't flourish. Oh, and he has this speech where Toledo talks about leftovers. Oh, well, we need to see the full spectrum of that. So by digging into the material, the questions that it caused me to ask led to visual solutions. So I feel as though I wasn't going, how do I, step on this play? It was, let me dig into this written material. Mm-hmm. Let's see what questions it arouses inside of me. And what are the solutions that I can come up with, which will then empower the dynamics that are already at play in the material, including moving it from winter, which is when the play is set, into summer. Because, urban landscapes in the summer are horrifying. The heat bounces off the concrete and into your body, and you feel like you're going to faint. And so I wanted to intensify. I made a decision. I talked with the production designer and the DP. I don't want see any trees in Chicago. I want to just remove nature. I want the sky to be white. I want the sun to be a white dot in a white sky. So it's alienating. There's no blue. There's no breeze. There's none of that going on. Just to magnify this kind of urban hellhole that this place was for somebody like Ma and for the members of her band. Mm-hmm. Whereas for Levy, it's Oasis.
And yeah.
He's going to buy some yellow shoes and he's going to become a star.
Yeah. I love that you actually transitioned it from a brutal Chicago winter to the brutal Chicago summer, because it really intensifies the oppressiveness and the stakes of that one day in these people's lives. And you literally see the summer heat dripping off of Viola Davis in every frame.
Absolutely. And also when you winter Chicago, which are brutal, the point is to survive them. It's like the point is to survive them right. Versus the summers, you can't, it's everywhere. You know, there are days in New York City during the summer, during August, where it's 90 degrees at night at 11 o'clock at night. And you just go, there is no relief. There is none. There is none.
I want to bring up an interesting irony behind the scenes of this movie. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is the only one of August Wilson's plays that doesn't take place in his hometown of Pittsburgh. It takes place in Chicago. And yet you shot the movie in Pittsburgh as a double for Chicago. Why?
I don't think I had ever been to Pittsburgh. And at one point we talked about Pittsburgh, but at one point we talked about Philadelphia. And then the thing which was really thrilling and surprising to me is that the architecture of Pittsburgh is so rich and so varied that it just became perfect. It just became perfect for me. And I went, oh, this is thrilling. And we would find, you know, the place where in Bronzeville, where Levy goes shopping for the shoes, you know, it was on this one block street that was somewhat, it was fine, but it was slightly worn down. And then right in the middle of it was this deco-shaped building that was that was not in the best of shape. And I just went, that's gotta be our shoe store, because you know, it's like it's the 20s, it's this. And everywhere we looked, we just kept on finding these locations that were just that evoked Chicago 1920s. And it was I fell in love with it. And the people in that tent show, some of the best extras I've ever worked with in my entire life. When Viola came on stage, they screamed for her as Ma Rainey, like she was a goddess and a superstar. And they were phenomenal. So Pittsburgh ended up being very, very lucky and fortunate place for us to shoot.
Yeah, I didn't realize that it was Pittsburgh until I read that it was Pittsburgh.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
It was a great, perfect stand-in for Chicago. And I would imagine that a lot of the buildings that, just because of the economic situation in Pittsburgh, are still standing there, would not be standing in Chicago. Chicago would have paved over many of those places.
Absolutely. And the thing which is interesting, the exterior of the building that we used for the recording studio, I think a day or two after we finished it, they gutted it.
Really?
They gutted it. And then in the section of Bronzeville, they were getting ready to tear down one of the places. So that gentrification dehistoryifying, not a word, but killing off the history and the architecture, it's still a lot there, but I could see we got there at the perfect time to get what we needed.
Now, the majority of the action in the film takes place in two rooms, a very spare, dank, claustrophobic rehearsal room for the band.
Yeah.
And then there's a much more open and brighter recording studio, which seems enormous by comparison where Ma is. What went into the look of those two rooms and what you wanted to convey with that?
Well, you know, interestingly, so Ma Rainey, the real Ma Rainey recorded with Paramount. And Paramount had inferior recording equipment compared to some of the recording studios in New York City. That was
really?
One. And also it was originally located in a building where they manufactured chairs. So the production designer built this chair manufacturing place inside. And once you get inside, you know, the booth. So it's very important to me that it was that I love crafting history in locations. So the idea was that the booth where the recording equipment is where the managers of the factory would be to observe the workers to make sure they were doing their job. So that hierarchical equation was used to mirror what's going on within the recording and the artists down below. And then in the band room, I wanted to create a sense, a subliminal sense of a boxing ring. That's why there are four columns there, and And at one point I argued because I didn't want a window because I didn't want a sense of escape. But then Mark Ricker, the production designer, put it up so high. I said, okay, that'll work. And then there was the door in and the door that in theory led to nowhere. And because I wanted the language between the guys to be popping and flying all over the place, that they're throwing punches with the language, you know? So it's kind of a raging bull energy going on, but instead of punches, it's the language. So that therefore, any time we see those four men in that room, it's about a conquering game. Who has the power? Who scored a punch? Who got wounded? Who's going to give back? Who's going to attack? And then just in a number of times, just when it looks like things might start to get intense, music ends up happening and it takes attention out of the room. And this keeps on happening and it takes attention out of the room until at the end of the film, when Levy has lost all hope, you know, and they're packing up their instruments, without that music, then the tension releases itself in something tragic and unfortunate.
Yeah, and I'm interested in how you cast those four musicians in Ma's band. It's such an interesting and diverse collection of characters, and each of them sort of represent a different take on what it means to be a Black man in America. Yeah. Tell me about that process.
Well, Chadwick, I think, you know, Denzel and I worked very closely on the casting.
Right,
and
the producer.
You know, he and I both wanted Viola. She said no about five times before she finally said yes. because she was...
Sounds like she's got a little bit of Ma Rainey in her, too.
But it was the exact opposite. She was going, I'm not a singer. Get somebody else who's a singer. Oh. So I'm not right for the role. And then I just said, don't think about the singing, just think about the role. And then she said yes. And then I brought up Chadwick, and then Denzel was excited by that. And then I directed Denzel in a production of Iceman Cometh on Broadway, and Michael Potts, who plays Slow Drag, was in it, and we both wanted him. And then Glenn is an extraordinary actor. Glenn was the original Travis, the little boy in Raisin in the Sun on Broadway. Back in 1955.
I heard that.
So he made his Broadway debut when he was 12.
Wow.
And
he's a brilliant actor.
And then Coleman, you know, Denzel and I both thought of Coleman. And so we offered, you know, everybody their roles. You know, there were auditions for Dusan and there were auditions for Dusty May. But the four guys, we just went, that's who we have to go with.
Now, coming from a theater background, are you a big believer in rehearsals on a movie?
Yes, absolutely. We had a 2-week rehearsal period.
Okay.
We rehearsed, absolutely. You know, I mean, I've worked with actors who don't like it because they're used to the equation of film. But in this case, with this language, you know, and it wanting it to crackle and fly, I wanted that time. Also, in a rehearsal period, you evolve a language. You figure out the actors, you figure out how to talk to them, and they figure out how to talk to you. And you build a sense of camaraderie and trust and space so that therefore when we're filming, you're way ahead. Meryl Streep mentioned to me one time, she said when they were doing Sophie's Choice, she said every morning they would get together with the director and just rehearse and then film in the afternoon. And it just moves things along because instead of actors using the filming time to figure out what they're doing, they're coming in prepared, ahead, and ready to dive in and do the work, which is not to say if they don't rehearse, they're not prepared and ready. But I find it very important. Yeah. And also everyone who was cast brought such an extraordinary skill set that I wasn't worried about them, you know, losing it. Mm-hmm. You know, the rehearsal process was just laying the foundation for these monster buildings that we were going to craft once we started filming.
Yeah, I honestly don't understand why any film director would forego a rehearsal, unless it was for budgetary constraints. But so many film directors do. And I honestly think that so much gets lost in that, in not having those actors play off of each other and have an idea of what the piece is about and all that.
Absolutely. I think everybody ends up empowered. But, you know, I've worked with some brilliant film actors who just don't want to. Yeah. Who just don't want to. they're saving it, which I understand, but, you know, we'll see. But it was this just affirmed how valuable and important and informative and freeing, ultimately, freeing a rehearsal process can be.
Well, from time to time, I've actually seen you act in film yourself. How does that inform the way you direct and work with actors?
Well, it makes me appreciate them all the more, and it makes me want to run home and never do it again and hide underneath the covers. And then I end up appreciating them all the more because of their bravery and their skills and their thing. You know, I've done it a few times, and always right at one point in the, I was an actor in college. And then I can't keep focused on acting and directing and writing, but acting in a film eternally reminds me of why I don't want to be an actor. Because after I do it two or three, twice, and then the third time, I'm going, can I go home? Can we move on? Why are you doing that angle? People are going to see the bald spot in my head. Why can't I start acting? I have this moment of ferocious commitment, and then I'm done. I want to go home. I'm done. Okay. Can you just shoot around me and just keep working with everybody else? That's when I went, George, no. You shouldn't do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think people understand how vain directors can be in their own way.
Oh, absolutely. How neurotic they are as well.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, when I first saw Viola Davis in this movie, I almost didn't recognize her. She looks like a totally different person. The makeup almost reminds me of Betty Davis and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And the costumes, by God. What went into physically transforming Viola into Ma Rainey, especially when you only had 7 photos to go on? Well, you really didn't have much of a reference.
You know, everybody did as much research as they possibly could, hearing people talk about her and everything, that she had a necklace with solid gold pieces around her neck, the gold teeth, you know, and that she was always sweating. They would frequently talk that she wasn't an attractive human being and all of this sort of stuff. And so, you know, and Viola gained a certain amount of weight, but then Anne Roth crafted, you know, a bodysuit to help fill it out and expand on Ma's weight, and then Viola had, you know, said for her idea, she wanted to be Aretha Franklin's size. That's what she wanted to walk around with, and that was important to her. And then we got the gold teeth, and then she was talking with Sergio, you know, her makeup person, about the look that she wanted and the sweat. And he told this story the other day. It's interestingly enough that when he was first putting on the makeup, biologist said, go for it, go for it, go for it. And he also told this other story. I worked with this makeup person on my first film, Lackawanna Blues, and she would talk about how the chorus girls at the Apollo Theater, because there was no makeup shade for people of varying color shades, that they would take shoe polish, mix it with water, and then smear it around their eyes to get this smoky eye look. And then Sergio, who is from Spain, told this wonderful story about his grandmother and his aunts during the war would find crushed berries and other objects from around the house or from around where they were living and use water to create the look. So it was just so fascinating to me that you have these women in Spain and these women in Harlem doing, in essence, making up for the lack of supplies. And so that sense of, so that when he talked about doing the makeup Viola, he got rid of all the brushes and he did it by hand. So that it did not have an exaggeratedly refined look at all. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I love about Viola is her vanity. She has no physical vanity. It's about surrendering to the material, surrendering the emotions, the visuals, whatever it takes to illuminate the character, to make the character real. And there's something incredibly brilliant and generous in that. And that's who she is, an artist. She will surrender whatever she must in order to make the character live and breathe.
Well, George, if I have this right, I believe that you shot this film in summer 2019 and wrapped post sometime around June or July of this year, just as Black Lives Matter protests were sweeping the country. Was there a part of you that wanted to move up the release date and get it out there to be a part of the conversation?
No, I was screaming. I said, release it now. Release it now.
Yeah.
And you know, why can't we? And then, you know, smarter brains were going, no, we need to release it. When we're going to release it. I said, but of course, the conversations are ongoing. So it was naive of me to think we got to get out there and join the conversation.
Right.
The conversation
right.
is ongoing.
True. Yeah. And it's strikingly relevant. I mean, you even, for Christ's sake, you even have a scene of Ma Rainey getting harassed by a white cop in Chicago.
Yes, so. But she doesn't back down. And
right.
There's this wonderful moment where you see, the cop going, I'm confused. I don't understand. I have power. You have none. No, she doesn't
right.
have power. You know, and it's just
right.
very interesting to me because in that moment, it's like when society tells you, you have no power, you either retreat into a corner or you claim every single ounce of power that you have and go forth into the world. And that's what Ma Rainey did. And it's thrilling to watch. It's thrilling that she brings a recording session to a halt until she gets her Coca-Cola.
Right.
And it's not about the Coke. Yeah. It's just about just to let you know I do have the power that I have.
Well, real quickly, what's up next for George C. Wolfe? Do you think we might even see you directing a full-blown musical for film sometime soon?
I would love that. I would love that more than anything. But I don't think it's going to be the next thing. But but I can't talk about the next thing yet. So I don't know. It's going to be a film. The next thing is going to be a film, knock on wood and all that sort of stuff. During the shutdown, while I was finishing up the film, I also did some writing. So I've been writing, I'm working on a play, working on a screenplay. So, trying to keep telling stories and hopefully tell stories that are startling and empowering.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll stay tuned for that. In the meantime, once again, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is just fantastic, is now playing in theaters and on Netflix, folks. You've got to see it. George C. Wolfe, thanks so much. This was great.
Well, thank you so much as well. Thank you. This was absolutely a lot of fun.
Thanks again to George C. Wolfe for coming on the show. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is now showing in theaters and streaming on Netflix. And now I'll take you out with this original recording of Ma Rainey singing the Chain Gang Blues.
The judge found me guilty, the clerk he wrote it down. The judge found me guilty, the clerk he wrote it down.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.